call to order this meeting of the Commerce Committee. We do have a quorum, and our first item of business is approval of our minutes from March 14th of 2023. Representative Katisa Watoon.
Mr. Chair, I would move approval of yesterday's minutes.
Representative Katisa Watoon moves approval of our minutes from March 14th, 2023. All in favor, I'm sorry, discussion to the motion. I'm trying to move quickly today, but all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. And the minutes from March 14th, 2023 are approved. The first bill on our agenda is House File 742 from Representative Norris. Welcome back to the committee, Representative Norris. While you're coming down, I will move House File 742 be recommended to be re-referred to the Environment and Natural Resources Finance and Policy Committee. Representative Norris, to your bill.
Chair Stevenson, we do have an A7 author's amendment. I don't know if we want to put that on right away.
The A7 author's amendment. Let me just make sure that that is... I don't think that's in our... I don't believe that's in our packets.
Okay.
So what we're going to do is we're going to ask that the staff get the amendment... printed, and once we see the amendment, we will figure out if we can take action on it. So
that
let's
works
move forward
me.
Without the amendment for the moment, and then we'll figure out our next steps.
Perfect.
We'll work on that.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson. And members, it's great to be back with you here in the Commerce Committee. House File 742 has to deal with PFAS, and in particular, how they relate to our firefighters. So I know you've had a number of PFAS bills come before you already this session. So you're familiar with the devastating health and environmental impact of these forever chemicals on Minnesotans more broadly. But one group of people who in particular are exposed to PFAS are our firefighters. PFAS is in the firefighting foam that they use, and PFAS are also in the turnout gear that they wear when they report to a call. So this bill is designed to set us on a course to, as rapidly as practically possible, transition away from the use of PFAS in both firefighting foam and in the turnout gear. Right now, we are prohibited from using PFAS-containing foam for training and testing situations. But what this bill does is it essentially says that starting January 1st, 2024, PFAS-containing firefighting foam is not allowed to be used in Minnesota, with a couple of exceptions. And that has to deal with a couple of unique types of facilities, the first being airports. So right now, the federal government actually requires that the airports use firefighting foam that contains PFAS. That guidance we expect is going to be changing. But we know that, you know, the day that that change is announced, our airports are not going to be able to just immediately transition over. So we've worked with the airports, and what we've put in place is essentially they've got a year from when that guidance comes down to make the transition. But if they're finding that they can't make that transition quite as quickly, either because there's still policy guidance that needs to be determined, if the foam isn't included in the FAA's qualified product database, or what the A7 amendment would say is if it's not commercially available, because we're all these airports, the DOD are going to be transitioning over. If the foam is simply not available yet, commercially available, then they can go to the state fire marshal, and the state fire marshal has discretion to give them some latitude in the timeline for that transition. The other unique type of facility that this bill deals with is our oil refineries and terminals. And for them, it sets up a system where they have until January 1st, 2026 to transition over. At that point, if they still need additional time to transition over, they can, again, appeal to the state fire marshal. The bill outlines a number of kind of requirements for giving them a waiver. But at that point, the state fire marshal can give them a waiver up until January 1st, 2028. So that's the firefighting foam piece. The other piece that I mentioned we have to deal with is the turnout gear. PFAS is in the turnout gear that the firefighters wear. The challenge there is we don't have a lot of commercially available perfect substitutes for that turnout gear right now. So instead, what we're doing is we're asking the MPCA to work with the Department of Health and essentially do a report to look at what are the current turnout gear requirements and what are some options for moving away from turnout gear with PFAS in it. Look at disposal methods and recommendations for future disposal of that turnout gear. And then a biomonitoring component. This would be an optional, voluntary thing for firefighters, but we would have the state set up a biomonitoring program so that firefighters who would like to participate in it and are worried about the health impacts of the PFAS can utilize that. And we appropriate $500,000 to the MPCA and in conjunction with the Department of Health to implement that biomonitoring. So with that, Mr. Chair, that's the kind of high-level overview of the bill, and I know I've got at least one testifier here who would like to speak to the bill.
All right. I think we will move to testifiers now, and I think we have Duluth Fire Chief Sean Criget. Chief, if you want to come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Good afternoon. My name is Sean Criget, and I am the City of Duluth Fire Chief. Thank you for allowing me to testify today on the dangers of AFFF foam and PFAS firefighting foams and the larger body chemicals referred to as fluorinated chemicals and their links to increased cancer in firefighters. PFAS, PFOA, and PFOS chemicals may be orally ingested, absorbed through the skin, or inhaled through exposure in the atmosphere. FEMA and the U.S. Administration Protection Against Exposure suggests that fire departments using AFFF with PFAS, PFOA, or PFOS should replace older AFFF stocks with fluorine-free foam solutions to lessen the chances of potential exposure. The Duluth Fire Department started moving to PFAS-free firefighting foam in 2014 and finally ended up paying $42 per 5-gallon pail to dispose of our final supplies in 2020. But now we need your help to reduce continued exposure to other firefighters and the environment, including the pristine shores of Lake Superior. These are considered forever chemicals that don't break down in the environment. We have contaminated land near the Duluth Airport and the 148th Fighter Wing that continues to threaten groundwater and runoff to Lake Superior. When a fire department uses PFAS foam, they are required to report the use to the State Fire Marshal's Division. Data provided to me from the State Fire Marshal's staff reported 246 fire department response incidents using PFAS foams from June 30th, 2020 through January 29th, 2022. We've heard during previous testimony that these cancer-causing foams are only used for emergency use. Although that is mostly true, there have been unintentional or accidental releases, sometimes caused by FAA-required vehicle foam proportioning system equipment testing. There are agreeable amendments to this legislation to allow PFAS foam use in industrial or refinery settings and for airport firefighting as required by the Department of Defense. But in my professional opinion, of these 246 incidents reported, only a few had a large enough fire potential to justify PFAS foam use. These were still not refinery or industrial fires, but tanker truck accidents with fires that could be more difficult to control due to the quantity of flammable liquids. Most of the emergency use reported to the State Fire Marshal's Division were dumpster, vehicle, or structure fires with Class A combustibles that, in our experience in Duluth, could have easily been extinguished with PFAS-free firefighting foam available today. This is truly a statewide issue, with reporting from a landfill in northern St. Louis County, which is my jurisdiction, to a structure fire in Rochester, to a semi-truck fire in St. Paul, to a farm equipment fire in Olivia, to an unintentional release at the airport. This is truly a problem for larger cities, small cities, with career departments, volunteer departments, outstate, and metro. Without this legislation, firefighters will continue to hear that we are working on it for years, if not decades to come. Supporting this legislation will ensure action. And I'll stand for any questions that I can try to answer if need be.
Thank you, Chief. Appreciate that. We'll move on to the next testifier, but if there's questions after that, we might invite you back down.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next, we have Tony Quillis. Mr. Quillis, if you'd come forward and proceed your testimony.
Afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Tony Quillis, and I'm representing the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, where I'm the Director of Environmental Policy. Mr. Chairman, members, in 2019, the legislature came to an agreement that prohibited testing and training of firefighting foam containing PFAS. So no one is supposed to be using this foam unless it is for one reason, and that is for an emergency situation. The current product is effective in putting out liquid fuel fires at airports, refineries, and other facilities. At these facilities, water just tends to spread the fire and in some cases accelerates the blaze. Alternatives are currently being tested, but they're still not approved by the Department of Defense or the FAA. And there's not just one alternative being tested and evaluated. There's many under review, and they're being tested in various types of fuels, situations, and scenarios, such as temperature, wind, snow, rain. And once they're tested, then they have to go through various types of equipment and storage receptacles, hoses, nozzles, to make sure it works there. They're making progress, but we're still not there yet, Mr. Chairman. So we need to make sure that this alternative is certified and accredited before we proceed. And whether that's with a neutral third party, somebody like the Underwriter Laboratories, the Department of Defense, or the FAA, we need to make sure that that alternative is certified and accredited. Then we need adequate timelines, Mr. Chairman, to make this switch. It's not just a simple can for can. We need to switch out suppression systems, irrigation systems, equipment, hangars at the airport. So we need to make sure that there's an adequate timeline there. And even among industrial facilities, they're different. Some are bigger than others. They use different fuel types. And we need to make sure that there's adequate training for the emergency personnel with this new product. And then I'd like to thank Representative Norris. We had had a conversation with stakeholders, and that's, I think, going to be referenced in the A7 amendment about making sure there is an adequate supply, because once this alternative is discovered, there's going to be a big demand for it. So we need to make sure that there's an adequate supply for it. And then also, finally, Mr. Chairman, just to make sure that all facilities and all situations are included, because we need to make sure that our first responders have the ability to respond in emergency situations, Mr. Chairman. I think we've been all working. We all share the same goal. We want to get to the same place. Mr. Chairman, I think keep working with Representative Norris and the stakeholders and the firefighters to try and get there. But, Mr. Chairman, just to make sure that we've got a certified and accredited alternative and make sure the timelines are adequate to make that change over, Mr. Chairman. So thank you for the ability to comment on House File 742.
Thank you. So because I didn't remember to state the time limit before the chief started, I didn't time the chief or Mr. Quillis. From here on out, we're going to limit all public testimony to 2 minutes. We just have a very packed agenda today. We do now have the A7 amendment distributed to members. I'm looking over at Representative O'Driscoll to see. It looks like we are okay there, so I will move the A7 amendment. Representative Norris, do you want to just really briefly tell us what the A7 does?
Yeah, thanks, Chair Stevenson. As I mentioned, this goes to kind of the commercial availability or supply chain challenges, specifically as they relate to airports. When the FAA changes their guidance and allows for the use of non-PFAS-containing foam, every facility in the country and potentially around the world is going to be trying to transition over. So there's going to be supply chain constraints, as we've experienced even in our daily lives. So this allows the state fire marshal to take that into account and give the airports some latitude in terms of their timeline for switching over.
Sounds good. Any discussion to the A7 amendment? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The A7 is adopted. Discussion to the bill. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Norris, and the testifiers. We're kind of caught in a kind of a little catch 22 situation, if you will, because we don't have a viable alternative, but we do have some alternatives that are out there. And the fact that this is used in extreme cases in an emergency situation and the amount of chemical that is used and the amount of chemical that is recovered is tracked, I think that should provide some peace of mind for folks. The thing that I don't want to have happen is I don't want to have our airports and our other facilities who rely on this for public safety to be compromised. And not having those tools available is something that's in the toolbox until we are very, very comfortable that we've got enough supply and we've got a reliable, if not more reliable, suppressant, our fire suppressant on here, and suppression system available. And so, Mr. Chair, again, I've got some concerns about the bill, but I think we're moving in the right direction on here. And I'm glad it's going back to the Environment Committee. And I see that there's also a fiscal ask in here. And Mr. Chair, I suspect you are glad that it's not your ask and that it's a different committee's ask for the, from the budget on that. So with that, Mr. Chair, thank you.
Seeing no further discussion, Representative Norris, closing comments.
Overall, I'll reiterate what I've said from the very start when I started working on this bill, that this is a danger to our firefighters. It's a danger to Minnesotans. It's a health threat. And so my commitment is that we make sure that we're not using this PFAS-containing foam a day longer than absolutely necessary here in Minnesota. I've engaged extensively with all the stakeholders. I think that's reflected in the bill. And I think we found a good approach that's going to balance the public safety need with the health risk for our firefighters, and appreciate the support for this bill.
All right. And with that, I will renew my motion that House File 742, as amended, be recommended to be re-referred to the Environment and Natural Resources Finance and Policy Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. House File 742, as amended, is recommended to be re-referred to the Environment and Natural Resources Finance and Policy Committee. The next item on our agenda is House File 1978 from Representative Ryer. The bill will be presented today, I believe, by Chair Liebling.
And Mr. Chair, as Representative Liebling is making her way to the testifier's table, she is 1-0 on Ryer bills so far.
Yeah. Perfect Hall of Fame batting average on these bills. Chair Liebling, would you like to move the bill to the Health Committee?
Yes, I would. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I move that House File 1978 be referred to the Committee on Health, Finance, and Policy. And there is an amendment. I think we want to adopt that, so I would move the A1 amendment, and it looks to me like a technical amendment.
Chair Liebling moves House File 1978 be recommended to be referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee, also moves the A1 amendment, which is an author's amendment getting the bill in the shape the committee would like to consider it. Discussion to the amendment. Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. A1 is adopted. Chair Liebling to the bill.
All right. Well, thank you, members. Once again, this is Representative Ryer's bill. I actually don't know that much about it, I have to say, but I have someone here with me who does, so I'm going to turn it over to her.
All right. Ms. Myatt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you, Chair Liebling, for your support on this one. My name is Emily Myatt, and I'm the Government Relations Director for the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network, and I'm here today to express coalition support for House File 1978. This bipartisan bill is all about connecting patients to the right treatment at the right time. The bill before you would require state-regulated insurers, medical assistants, and Minnesota Care to cover biomarker testing when this testing meets medical and scientific evidence, which the standards are defined in the bill. In Minnesota, some insurers are already covering this testing, but this is about making sure that plans play by the same rules and keep up with science. Biomarker testing is the analysis of a patient's tissue, blood, or biospecimen for the presence of a biomarker. Biomarker testing is not a screening tool, it is not genetic testing, and it's not tests like 23andMe. There is robust medical and scientific evidence to demonstrate the effectiveness of biomarker testing, so the bill before you has clear parameters requiring coverage only for tests that will benefit patients. I had biomarker testing when I was diagnosed 13 years ago with an early stage cancer. I recently talked to an oncologist who specializes in my rare type of cancer, and testing has evolved so much since that time. He told me that a new biomarker test may have indicated that I didn't need to have my colon removed as a 19-year-old sophomore in college. But this bill isn't just about oncology. It's about patients with ALS, with lupus, or with arthritis. It's about the research happening on biomarker testing for Alzheimer's and for heart disease. This bill is all about current and future patients getting the right treatment. In your packet, you'll find a letter of support from more than 40 organizations spanning from hospitals, medical professionals, and patient advocacy groups, along with some written testimony from medical providers who couldn't get out of seeing patients today for committee. This bill has gone through the mandate review process, and that report found, despite evidence to support the use of biomarker testing, insurance coverage for testing varies, and that variation isn't always based on clinical practice guidelines. The bill would result in a premium impact of 9 to 22 cents per member per month in the first year, but it does not take into account cost savings. Timely access to biomarker testing means patients can get the most effective treatment for their disease. More effective treatment means less side effects, which means lower healthcare costs. Finally, there's a widening racial, economic, and socioeconomic and geographic gap for those who do and don't have access to this type of testing. Consistent coverage for biomarker testing is key to reducing health disparities, improving patient quality of life, and potentially reducing costs. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Jean Junker. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Just state your name for the record. Proceed to your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Stevenson and committee members. My name is Jeannie Junker. I'm a resident of Cottage Grove, a wife, a mother of two unbelievably beautiful adult children, a senior leader at a Minnesota-based company, and 5 years ago, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. I'm here today to tell you my story and ask that you support House File 1978. In the summer of 2018, I was diagnosed with stage one breast cancer. I've always taken my health seriously by staying on top of my screenings, and I was so incredibly thankful that it was caught early. Even so, it was still one of the scariest moments of my life. Cancer didn't just impact me, it impacted my family, my friends, and my coworkers. It literally impacts everyone in your circle. I'm sure many of you have been there for yourself, for your friends, or your family. When someone you care about tells you they have cancer, you feel helpless. After I was diagnosed, my doctor recommended biomarker testing. The biomarker testing results showed that my cancer would not be responsive to chemotherapy, so we had to look at other options. We developed a plan that included a lumpectomy and radiation, and after I finished the surgery and my radiation treatments, I was put on tamoxifen, a medication that can reduce the risk of my cancer ever returning. This summer, I will be reaching my five-year mark since my cancer diagnosis. Yes, 5 years free of cancer. It feels so good to say that, but that my journey doesn't end there. Once again, my doctors will be using biomarker testing to predict the risk of my cancer returning in the 5 to 10 year range and to determine if I should continue my medication longer to continue to decrease my risk of the cancer returning. I'm beyond grateful and thankful that I had biomarker testing completed when I did. Chemotherapy would have done absolutely nothing for my cancer and would have had a significant impact on my quality of life and most certainly my family. I was not only able to avoid the horrible side effects of chemotherapy, but the cost too. I'm so glad I got the treatment that was right for me and my cancer. I was also lucky that my insurance covered the cost of my test. I was stunned to learn that that is not the case for all Minnesotans. Oncologists should be able to offer their patients the best possible treatments based on science. That's what biomarker testing gave me, and more Minnesotans should have access to this innovative care, and they shouldn't have to be on the hook for hundreds of thousands of dollars to cover this expense out of pocket. We all know that it's not possible for everyone. Please remove barriers to biomarker testing and pass House File 1978. Thank you for the opportunity to hear why this matters to me, my family, and so many other Minnesota families.
Thank you for your testimony, and congratulations on being 5 years cancer-free. That's wonderful to hear.
Thank you.
Is there a discussion to the bill? Seeing no discussion, Chair Liebling, I will renew your motion that House File 1978, as amended, be recommended to be referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. House File 1978, as amended, is recommended to be referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. The next item on our agenda is House File 2371 from Representative Bierman. Representative Bierman, once you are settled, you may move your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move the DE for the bill, House File 2371.
So Representative Bierman moves House File 2371 be recommended to be referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee, and also moves the DE1 amendment. I take it this is an author's amendment?
This is an author's amendment reflecting technical assistance from the Departments of Health and Commerce.
All right. Any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails, and the DE1 is adopted. Representative Bierman, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members, for hearing House File 2371 today. This bill responds to the need for access to psychiatric residential treatment facility care for all Minnesota children. Our state's commercial plans have not included PRTF in their benefit set for over the 5 years of PRTF services being available in Minnesota. Children with mental illness who demonstrate medical necessity for PRTF level of care are being denied care simply because their family's commercial insurance refuses to cover the service. A January 2023 report prepared by the Department of Commerce reviewed the proposal outlined in House File 2371. The report is included in your packets for today and outlines public health and child well-being benefit with access to intensive mental health care, no identified defrayal costs to the state under the Affordable Care Act, the only costs associated with the proposal being related to the state employee group insurance program. So the bill language includes PRTF care in chapters 62A, subdivision 3 on prohibited provider discrimination, 62K, subdivision 4 on network adequacy, 62Q, designating essential community providers, and 62Q, outlining behavioral health services. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move to my one of two testifiers and have the committee hear from first one up right now.
All right. I believe this must be Richard Woliat.
That's correct.
All right. You may state your name for the record. Proceed
with
your
testimony. Thank you, sir. Richard Woliat. Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for this opportunity. My name is Richard Woliat, and I am the public policy consultant for Northwood Children's Services. For the past 14 years, I served as the organization's president and CEO. I am a licensed mental health professional, and I have 45 years of experience in providing mental health services to kids and families. Northwood is located in Duluth, Minnesota, and we're in our 140th year of providing services to children and families from all across the state of Minnesota. Northwood is very much on the front lines of addressing the current mental health crisis and operates a full continuum of mental health services, including outpatient, in-home, day treatment, school-based services, crisis stabilization, group homes, and residential treatment, including a psychiatric residential treatment facility, or a PRTF as they're known. We serve about 300 kids a day in our various programs. I am grateful for you for hearing 2371 on this critical issue of access to the PRTF level of care. HF 2371 is supported by the Mental Health Legislative Network. As you're aware, we're experiencing a mental health crisis in this state, and unfortunately, as needs have increased, the capacity to provide services to meet those needs has diminished. This bill will ensure access to a much-needed level of care for all of our state's children, not only those eligible for Medicaid benefits. Northwood was the first organization to provide PRTF care in Minnesota beginning in July of 2018. There are currently two other PRTFs operating in the state, and there are plans to expand further. Northwood serves 36 children a day in our PRTF program. The PRTF level of care has proven to be effective. Combination of intensive psychiatric oversight, 24-hour nursing care, frequent psychotherapy, and enhanced staffing ratios has had the intended impact on kids and families, which is a brief, intensive level of residential treatment that provides stabilization so the kids can, upon discharge, thrive at home, in their schools, and in their communities. During the almost 5 years we have provided PRTF services, only one insurer has contracted with us for the PRTF level of care, and this insurer will soon be acquired by the United Health Group. Ironically, many of these insurers are required to provide coverage for the service in their state Medicaid contracts, but refuse to do so on the commercial side. This despite innumerable meetings and phone calls of company clinicians and other senior staff to describe the service and to seek contracts. They simply refuse to include PRTF in their benefit set. Access to this critical service for kids and families should not only be determined by the insurance company they happen to have, especially now with kids boarding in emergency departments, spending way too much time in psychiatric hospitals. We must sustain and grow the capacity to address acute needs that we are faced with. PRTF is a proven, efficacious level of care and should be accessible to all of our kids and families. Families seeking admission to the PRTF are often frustrated and angry when informed that their insurance will not cover their child's care. That frustration quickly turns to fear and anxiety because these situations are very often life-threatening. We have an opportunity to deal with that and to address that and hopefully to make a positive change. Thank you very much for your consideration.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Abigail Morgan. Morgan, if you could just come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Abby Morgan, and I am the foster mom to an incredibly loving, empathetic, and resilient 14-year-old girl who I will refer to as Anna. Anna came to live with me after her discharge from the most intensive residential care a youth can access in Minnesota. She came to my house with no resources to meet her immediate needs due to long wait lists and limited community-based services. 2 weeks after entering a partial hospitalization program, she was kicked out due to unsafe behavior, beginning a cycle as Anna continued to display acute and life-threatening behaviors while accessing treatment, only to be discharged because they couldn't meet her needs. And the hospital continued to deny her admission to the emergency psych unit. We felt alone and unsupported by the system that was supposed to help us the most. Eventually, the hospital became my last option to keep her safe. The emergency room one day called me and said I had 24 hours to pick her up because they couldn't accommodate her needs or they were going to call Child Protection and report me for neglect. I found myself asking, how can we as parents be expected to provide for our child in a home setting if the hospital is stating they can't meet her needs? Finally, Anna was accepted by our PRTF, Northwood Children's Services in Duluth, Minnesota. She planned to arrive there at Northwoods on December 15th. However, her primary insurance is a commercial insurance plan, and they don't cover PRTF level of care. We were told she'd lose her spot at Northwood if we couldn't pay the $631 a day for treatment out of pocket. Insurance issued a residential treatment facility denial, which Northwoods couldn't accept as the denial because they are a psychiatric residential treatment facility, not an RTF. On December 27th, insurance sent a denial letter to Northwood stating, this is not a denial letter as we don't recognize this level of care. So she remained sitting in the hospital emergency room. On December 28th, Anna's county worker helped get a new letter, but this had incorrect authorization dates for service. Finally, on January 3rd, Northwoods received a correct denial letter and Anna was admitted to the PRTF 3 weeks after her original admission date. On that day, I was afforded my first night's sleep in months, deeply relieved from not having to agonize over Anna's safety. Anna began to stabilize in a way that I never knew was possible because of the PRTF. With each family therapy session and phone call with Anna, I regained a little piece of my life back. It is incredibly important and vital to our youth's mental health and survival that PRTFs are recognized and covered by all commercial insurance plans. Thank you.
All right, we'll now move to member discussion to the bill. Discussion to the bill. Seeing none, closing comments. Representative Bierman. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Pisa-Batun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Abby, I just wanted to say thank you for being a foster parent and for looking out for the children who are the most in need of support in the entire state of Minnesota. I think that most of us cannot imagine having to call 911 because of a violent altercation with one of our children. And we never hope to, right? But this sort of service is so necessary to meet our children where they are. And the soonest that we can intervene, we know early intervention makes a difference year by year. And then that's, it comes directly back to us. Our investment comes directly back to us then in education costs, special education costs, in public safety costs, and on down the line. And so, Representative Bierman, I appreciate you bringing this bill forward. It's something that we need to definitely do our due diligence on and make sure that these kids are supported.
Chair Lieberman.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Bierman, for carrying this bill. I really appreciate it. I just want to add one other piece that's so important about this bill, and that is that We know right now our hospitals are really having a problem with being unable to discharge people. And, of course, it's patients of many different kinds where there's nowhere to place them. And so I think this is another little piece that will help with that problem. And, of course, when there's somewhere to discharge people to, it also means there's less compression of patients in the emergency department. So I really think this is a very important bill, and thank you so much for carrying it.
Closing comments. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for member comments regarding those issues, because this is all connected to care, both upstream and downstream, and will make a big impact. So glad to be doing the work with all of you. Thank you.
And with that, Representative Bierman renews his motion that House File 2371, as amended, be recommended to be re-referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. House File 2371, as amended, is recommended to be re-referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. We will now
right. The next bill on our agenda today is House File 1935. Chair Stevenson, would you like to move your bill?
Madam Chair, I move House File 1935 be laid over for possible inclusion.
Chair Stevenson moves that House File 1935 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. To your bill, Mr. Chair.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House File 1935 relates to the mandate review process that is a couple years old right now. And I will say that I find the information that the mandate reviews provide to be very helpful as we think about bills and as chair, as I think about what bills to hear. And I'm really grateful for the great work of the Commerce Department and also for all of the stakeholders who participate in that process. And I also will say that I've recently learned about similar efforts that other states do, including California. And so I think we're well in line on what we're doing on this. House File 1935, I'm going to talk about what it does right now and also a little bit about where I'm intending to kind of go with this when we come back in a couple of weeks with an omnibus. What it does right now is it has us, instead of just looking forward at new mandate proposals, take a look backward at some of our existing law and try and look at it from a cost-benefit analysis to see if what we're doing continues to make sense. Some of the mandates for private health insurance that are in our system are quite dated, and I think it does make sense to look back and just say, hey, is this still something that from a cost-benefit perspective makes sense for people who have health insurance in the state of Minnesota? What we are looking at is trying to do, there are obviously many mandates. We're not looking to do them all at once. We would be looking to do a few at a time under this proposal, but that's where we are currently with 1935. There's a couple other issues with 62J, the mandate review process, that I'm hoping that we will address in the omnibus when it comes back, that are perhaps a little more technical in nature, but are worth noting now just to get on the committee's radar screen so you know what's coming down the road. One is we had some language that I think was added as an amendment to our omnibus last year and, in fact, made it all the way to the Jobs, Energy, Commerce Conference report that was never adopted but was produced that relates to how trade secret information is handled in a mandate review, and I would intend to try and finish that job this year. The second issue is a novel one that came up this year actually because of a bill that Representative Kraft has relating to hearing aids. Representative Kraft's bill really is kind of bringing Minnesota law into compliance with federal law. I'm not sure it makes sense to do a full-on mandate review when we have, the feds are requiring coverage of something anyway, and state law really has no discretion. So I intend to add some language saying that when that situation arises, a mandate review isn't necessary. But that is kind of the lay of the land, Madam Chair. I know there's a couple people wanting to testify as to this bill as it currently exists.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So first on the list, I have Bentley Graves with the Chamber of Commerce. And introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Bentley Graves with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I want to thank Chair Stevenson for bringing this legislation forward. You hear a lot from us on behalf of our members when it comes to proposals that are before the legislature, before this committee, as they relate to the cost of health insurance. This is an idea that we think has a lot of merit of taking, as the chair said, taking the main review process and kind of looking backwards retrospectively on things that have already been added to statute by the legislature, all things that are there and intended to help someone, but all also likely come with some cost. This would allow both stakeholders and the legislature to get a better sense of what's currently baked into premiums today, but also a better understanding of the mandates that are in statute. To whom do they apply? Do they just apply to small and mid-sized businesses and individuals in the full insured market? Do any of them apply to the larger segments of the market? Which apply to public programs? Which apply to commercial programs? But also, you know, which of these are still supported by current medical practice? Are they all, has medical practice moved beyond in some respects? And again, I think it would just give us all a much better sense of what's in statute today and a better sense of, the cost benefit that the mandate review process is intended to give us all. So, again, I want to thank Chair Stevenson for bringing this forward today. We think this is a great proposal and will offer a lot to the discussion that we all have on an ongoing basis about this subject. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Graves. Next, I have Peter Brickwitty, Department of Commerce. Introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, for the record, Peter Brickwitty from the Commerce Department. I want to thank Representative Stevenson for bringing this bill forward. I think we have a very worthy goal in this bill, trying to examine the value proposition for mandates. I think the department is looking forward to continuing to work with the chair because we think the 62J process as it exists today looking forward may be a bit of a clunky fit looking retrospectively at existing benefits in the law. As the chair said, there are several other models from other states that drill down on the topic of healthcare value more specifically than we think the 62J process can, including that process that's established in the state of California in the California Health Benefits Review Program, which I've learned just this week goes by the delightful acronym of CHRBRP, which is something we should just
CHRBRP.
CHRBRP, yeah. Pronounce the full acronym, yeah. The University of Michigan also has a program, and the state of Virginia also have two other examples of entities that examine.
Any fun acronyms there?
Less so, Madam Chair. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Really puts California at the top of the list, I think. I think, well, the 62J process provides valuable information to policymakers as you make choices about bills, looking backwards and evaluating the actual performance is that part that I think could be, or that we think could be a little bit of a clumsy fit. I think I'd draw kind of two additional thoughts for consideration as this moves forward for possible inclusion. Representative Tabke has a bill that has a portion of it that I think fits well with that value proposition proposal, looking at things that are past going forward and tracking them through time, having the health plans look at what their projected costs are and then comparing them to actual costs over time does seem to be a useful tracking mechanism and to be in line with that value proposition review. I'd also draw a distinction between the ease of looking at some of the benefits that were on the books prior to the passage of the ACA versus those that have been added by the legislature moving forward. There are only a handful. The legislature has been very judicious in adding to the mandated mandated coverage requirements in the state law since the passage of the ACA. So I think the universe of things could be quite different. And mandated benefits that have been on the books in that pre-ACA environment might be a little bit more difficult to unpack. So we will continue to work on this with the chair. Happy to stand for questions, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brickwitty. Are there any members of the public who would wish to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we will move to member discussion and questions. I see Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Brickwitty, I didn't mean to have you run so quickly because I do have some questions for you, sir. I really like the spirit and intent of this bill, that we just don't put things into legislation and not loop back and review those. We should do this not only in insurance mandates, but in many other parts and aspects of Minnesota government. But this is a start. And Mr. Brickwitty, one of the questions that I have for you is, as you go through and do this review, are you anticipating that you would be bringing in the insurance payers I should say the payers on here, the insurance companies, and asking them what their background is and asking them what the usage is and helping to make some of those decisions and recommendations.
Mr. Brickwitty.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, yes, because the bill would require us to use the 62J process that exists in law today. So the plans have contributed to that analysis that we have provided that are prospective to date. So I anticipate them being a participant in a retrospective review as well.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Brickwitty, to that same idea, do you anticipate that that it's not an all or nothing type of recommendation on the mandates, that if technology, medical advances, different kinds of things have been modified or changed since those mandates were put into place, would you also be bringing back modified recommendations to mandates that are currently there versus we must keep it or we must not keep it as a mandate?
Mr. Brickwitty.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, if I'm understanding your question correctly, I think the answer would be no, because the current 62J reports that we do prospectively don't make a recommendation on whether or not the legislature should or should not pass a proposal into law. So that's not the purpose of the report. It's the purpose is to provide information to you all as public policymakers to make choices with. So I would not anticipate a retrospective 62J report to produce a recommendation on what the legislature should do to act. It would be information upon which you could make choices with.
Representative O'Driscoll. Members, any further discussion? All right, seeing none, Mr. Chair, you can have the last word.
Look forward to continue working on this, and we'll see it again in an omnibus.
Chair Stevenson renews his motion that House File 1935 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill, and the bill is laid over.
All right, the last item on our agenda today is House File 544. Chair Freiberg, you want to move your bill?
Sure, I move that House File 544 be laid over for possible inclusion.
Chair Freiberg moves House File 544 be laid over for possible inclusion. And I think what we'll do first is have you introduce the bill. Representative Freiberg, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to present House File 544 to you today. This is the white bagging choice legislation that's been around for a couple of years now. And I'm here before you today as the concerns that were raised last year continue today. As the committee that oversees consumer protections, I appreciate your consideration of how this current practice impacts consumers, who in these cases are patients, and why we're seeking this legislation to ensure their protection. House File 544 would prohibit an insurer from mandating the practice known as white bagging, which is when an insurance company mandates that a patient and their provider seek clinician-administered drugs, clinician-administered injectable medications through a designated specialty pharmacy. Due to business acquisitions in recent years, there is greater vertical alignment between insurers, PBMs, and specialty pharmacies, including ownership or financial incentive structures. This is why we've increasingly observed white bagging, as it's a financial benefit to these organizations. The language would allow white bagging to still take place if it is agreed upon by an insurer and provider. Sometimes white bagging is in the best interest of the patient, but as you'll hear from testifiers today, the current mandated practice of white bagging has caused patient harm and increased cost. Those mostly impacted by white bagging include patients with multiple sclerosis, cerebral palsy, cancer, rheumatoid arthritis, rare eye diseases, and several other conditions. As shared with me, patients impacted by this practice oftentimes find their prescribed medications to be out of network and not covered by a patient's insurance if dispensed by a pharmacy at a local healthcare provider. As a result, white bagging requires patients to use a distant, insurer-mandated pharmacy, which fractures the patient-provider care relationship and sometimes creates cost burden for the patient by shifting the type of insurance benefit from medical to pharmacy. This process interrupts the normal course of treatment and blocks providers' ability to deliver the best possible care and service to their patients. Other states are taking action to prohibit this mandated practice. As we've seen by action in other states, prohibiting the mandated practice of white bagging does not change plan design for an insurance product. White bagging creates risks for patients across Minnesota by sourcing drugs outside the normal supply chain, putting patients at risk of increased cost, and creating delays in medication administration that significantly affect patient health. For so many reasons, but most importantly for the patients who need these medications at a critical time in their care journey, whether at a clinic, infusion center, or hospital that their providers recommend, please help me pass House File 544. In your packet is a letter of support from the oncologists and the Healthcare Distribution Alliance, and I do have a certain number of testifiers here. There was some confusion about how many we will be allowed, although it looks like we have more time than I thought we would.
Well, we do have time. So when we get to the testifiers, we're going to do 2 minutes of 2 minutes apiece, as I described earlier. Before we move to testifiers, I do want to just briefly kind of talk about our roadmap for this hearing and going forward. So this, as Chair Freiberg indicated, is an issue that's been around for a few years, and it does have strong feelings in a couple different directions, which is not unusual for this committee. It's also not unusual in this committee for us to try and bridge that gap and find a sort of negotiated resolution, which is what I hope will happen with this bill. So we are going to hear first from some folks who are testifying on behalf of the bill that Chair Freiberg has brought forward. In members' packets, there is a DE1 amendment that takes a different approach to this issue. And then after hearing from the testifiers to Chair Freiberg's bill, we will hear from people who would advocate for that approach. We will not be voting on the amendment or the bill today. We will be laying the amendments kind of being heard informationally, to kind of borrow a phrase, and then the bill is going to be laid over. But I do expect to revisit this issue in the omnibus with the hopes that no legislator comes back to the committee next year saying, this is that white bagging bill that we've been hearing about for several years. That's the point. with that, we'll move to the testifiers for the bill, starting with Scott Sofji, I think. I got it?
Sefji, but that's
Sefji,
close enough.
I'm sorry.
It's okay, close enough.
Please proceed to your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to speak on behalf of House File 544. My name is Scott Sefji. I am Director of Pharmacy Cancer Care Services at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester. The practice known as white bagging is a growing concern. Imagine, if you will, you're the manager of a restaurant, and certain members of the people who have reservations in your restaurant today have been sending you raw boxes of food and ingredients for your chefs and your staff to prepare. That's what we deal with white bagging. We don't always know where these things came from. We know they came from a specialty pharmacy. That's all that we know. And it is a significant problem. Patient choice is a foundation of Minnesota healthcare. And this mandate removes patient choice. We have worked hard to develop safety processes in hospitals. The mandate of white bagging removes these safety processes because it mandates where we get the drug, and it disrupts our supply chain, and it disrupts our safety processes built into our electronic medical records. In a 2021 national survey of 6,000 U.S. health systems, 92% of respondents have experienced patient care issues with white bagging. And you're going to hear more today from our testifiers. There are federal supply chain regulations that require the pedigree trace, track and trace, from the manufacturer to the pharmacy. White bagging bypasses that because the specialty pharmacy is not required by the law to send the track and trace information to the clinic. We do not know as providers where these drugs have come from. We do not know the source, and therefore they are not part of our quality processes, and they're not quality and the safety processes that we've developed. The payers and PBMs are going to try to switch this and tell you that this is a cost savings issue, and they're going to try to frame it as payment reform. They're going to say that this is our fault because we charge too much. But when you truly look at this case, patients end up paying more because the switch from the medical benefit to the pharmacy benefit increases co-pays, co-insurance, and out-of-pocket. Providers pay more because we end up absorbing all of the cost of the receiving, handling, storing, preparation, and dispensing of drugs.
Mr. Sefji, I have to ask you to conclude your testimony.
Thank you. I urge your support.
Thank you, sir. Next, we have Brenda Reinhart.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Brenda Reinhardt, and I am the business office manager at Retina Consultants of Minnesota. We're a group of ophthalmologists subspecialized in the back of the eye, treating blinding diseases such as age-related macular degeneration, diabetic retinopathy, and vein occlusions. Had you come to see us 20 years ago, we would have had little to offer. But now we have a classification of drugs called anti-VEGF intravitreal injections. We take these medications and we inject them into the back of the eye. They do an amazing job of absorbing the blood that is growing in the back of the eye, as well as reduce swelling. We have been dealing with white bagging for many years now, and I just want to share with you some of the issues that have come up. We have had patients who we've had 6 months before we were able to get their first drug. We have issues with drugs expiring in a very short time. By the time the patient needed it, the drug was expired. I have had situations with prior authorizations. We obtain a prior authorization. We go ahead and inject. One thing I failed to mention, these patients need these injections every 4 to 6 weeks. A delay of even 1 week can cause loss of vision, which may or may not come back. So we have received a prior auth. We go ahead and inject. A week later, we get a letter in the mail saying this drug was supposed to be obtained through specialty pharmacy. We have lost the ability to negotiate and get any money for those types of payments. I currently have on my desk a 30-year-old woman who is, we're trying to get her drug. We had it, we white bagged her for the last 2 years. This year, I am fighting between her health plan and the PBM. Health plan says yes. They are responsible. PBM says, no, we are not responsible. And again, this is a 30-year-old woman. We want to keep working. Please help us save our patients' lives and their visions by supporting this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next, we have Mallory Snyder. Please come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Mallory Snyder, and I serve as the pharmacy business manager at Children's Minnesota. I'm grateful to join you here today in support for House File 544. White bagging is a practice that continues to negatively impact our patients and our ability to care for them. Today, I want to tell you the story about a 4-year-old patient with a rare autoimmune disease who requires medication via infusion. Back in September of 2022, the patient's family was told by their insurance provider that they would need to have their medication delivered to them and then administered at a standalone infusion center. However, no standalone infusion center would accept this 4-year-old patient. There is nowhere else for this family to go. This is not uncommon. Standalone infusion centers often are not equipped to serve young pediatric patients, and as a result, often turn kids away. Because there is no other infusion center available for this child, my colleagues and I continue with the patient's medical insurance and working with the pharmacy benefit plan to figure out a way to have the medication filled and administered at Children's Minnesota while still being covered by the family's insurance. The process is still going on 6 months later. It's agonizing both for the patient family and the care team. Our clinic staff, pharmacists, financial coordinators, and payer contracting analysts have spent over 75 staff hours trying to figure out resolution for this patient so that they can get the medication they need. During that time, the patient's family was also making multiple calls to their medical insurer and the pharmacy benefit plan, trying to find a solution, fearing that their child's medication would be delayed because of this process. Ultimately, the family decided to take the financial risk and have the infusion administered at Children's before the insurance issues were resolved. We're continuing to negotiate with the insurance company on behalf of this patient. The family still does not know how much this infusion will cost them and whether insurance will cover any portion of the cost. This is unacceptable, and it could have been avoided if the medication was filled and administered in our clinic to start. There are many, many more stories like this one, which is why this bill is so needed. Thank you, Representative Freiberg, and thank you for your leadership and support.
Thank you. Next, we have Molly Skifstad. State your name for the record. Proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Molly Skifstad, and I've been a pharmacist here in Minnesota for over 15 years, working in Essentia Health in our ambulatory infusion centers. Unfortunately, during this time, I've witnessed the rise of white bagging and the impacts this is having to our patients and the care we're able to provide. It is this impact to care that you see this legislation being spurred across the country and adopted in other states, irrespective of political affiliation, and being led by providers. The bill before you today, House File 544, is about protecting quality care and safety for Minnesotans. It was started by pharmacists, and it represents a coalition of over 20 healthcare systems, provider groups, and professional associations. While we are advocating for care quality and safety, the opponents of this bill will attempt to make it about payment reform. To acknowledge this, biologic medications have comprised over a third of new medication approvals this past decade. What this unfortunately has done is increased the cost of care in this space through the growth of volumes and these high-cost medications. But what it has fortunately done is provided patients with cancer, rheumatoid arthritis, Crohn's, and many other diseases hope and relief that they did not previously have. The rise in cost in this area is not due to providers marking up medications. This just is looking to distract and derail from the heart of this bill and the real issue that has brought this forward to you today. As you heard from the previous testifiers, providers and patients are trying to get their medications, only to be ran in circles and dismissed. You'll hear this disregard for the problem in the opponent's objections, just falling short of calling Minnesota providers liars. White bagging is not bad when patient care and safety is prioritized. We're not looking to eliminate it completely, but to ensure that patients are safe and getting high quality care that we are known for here in Minnesota. Minnesota providers diagnose, prescribe, compound, dispense, and ultimately care for patients. What current poor white bagging practices lead to is diagnosis, prescribing, delay, delay, delay. We appreciate that this committee has jurisdiction to protect customers. These are known to us as patients. And that is what we're asking for you to address today. Minnesota providers are telling you white bagging is impacting quality care and patient safety.
And I need to ask you to wrap up your testimony.
That's what we're asking for today, yep. So that's not what we want for our patients, and I don't think it's what you want for your constituents. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Okay, now we will move to discussing, I think, the DE1, and we'll start with Margaret Reynolds. Ms. Reynolds.
Chair Stevenson, members of the committee, my name is Margaret Reynolds. I'm here today on behalf of Cigna. I submitted testimony, it should be in your packets, to the first engrossment of the bill. I'll just walk through the amendment and happy to answer questions. This is an amendment that we think is patient-focused, addresses the concerns on cost containment, but certainly there's more that can be done on the patient safety side. That's been an ongoing discussion with the proponents of this bill. And, you know, we could certainly talk about track and trace, expiration, prior auths. So there is more work to be done. I'm glad this will be laid over and discussions can be ongoing. But to the DE1, subdivision 2, we insert the term in-network to make it clear that, you know, our networks are all certified by the Department of Commerce. That's a cost containment tool and plan design. So ensuring that the provider and the pharmacy is in-network is important. Also, the addition of terms and conditions for the payment, that gets at really the heart of the issue with our cost containment. Paragraph 2 on line 2.2 also includes the term in-network. Lines 2.5 through 2.10 are really focused on safety for the patient and the drug. Lines 2.14 through 2.19 is transparency for the enrollee should they choose to obtain the drug from the healthcare provider rather than the specified pharmacy. This is just informing the patient of the costs associated with that. Subdivision 3 is mostly the same as the first engrossment. However, on line 3.2, the word higher is inserted rather than lower, and that goes back to the payment of the drug. And then paragraph B on lines 3.4 and 3.5 allow for the contracting between the plan and the provider, so that this section of law doesn't interfere with any contracted rates that might have been discussed. Subdivision 4, striking paragraph 3, that has home infusion and external sites. For patients who might have mobility challenges, home infusion really is the best option for them to receive these drugs and their care. So we want to ensure that that is still an option for those patients. And then leaving the effective date that was changed in HHS committee. So that is a good faith effort to try and move toward compromise. Again, this has been well over a year of ongoing discussions, and hopefully my friends back there can give you some more to think about.
Thank you, Ms. Reynolds. Before we listen to your friends back there, I do want to give Chair Freiberg an opportunity if he wants to react to the DE1.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I do appreciate the attempt to find compromise. I don't know that this was worked on with all of the relevant stakeholders, and I haven't had a chance to fully digest everything in the amendment. Based on what I've seen, I'm not sure I'd support everything in it. For example, it doesn't retain the requirement that's in Subdivision 2 of the first engrossment that clinician-administered drugs be covered as medical benefits. That could potentially raise the cost to consumers. But whatever ends up happening here, I do pledge to continue to work with stakeholders and appreciate your efforts.
Great. We'll now move to the rest of the testimony on the bill and the amendment. And we'll start with Mr. Andreessen, Dan Andreessen.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dan Andreessen with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. If drugs are arriving in clinics mislabeled or damaged, then someone in that distribution chain is violating federal laws and regulations, and we need to fix that situation. Requiring white bagging is not standard practice by council health plans, and we cover around 92% of the fully insured market, which is the only commercial insurance market that this bill will impact. If providers are worried about the future of white bagging requirements, they already possess the power to avoid this by ending their practice of marking up the prices of the specialty drugs that they administer. It is because of these markups that other insurance carriers require white bagging, because the cost to the patient is significantly less when a drug is acquired from a specialty pharmacy. What I mean by markups is that a provider will buy a drug at a certain price from a distributor and then bill a patient for the price of that drug above what the clinic paid for that drug. And this can be anywhere from 200 to 300% or more. Here's an example of how it works from a patient perspective, and this is a medical bill from somebody that I know and have seen. So this Minnesotan has multiple sclerosis. They go and they get their insurance in the fully insured market, go to a clinic to get their six-month infusion, and that clinic acquires their own drugs. It's a buy-and-bill situation. If that patient would have called up the manufacturer and just bought it right from the manufacturer, that six-month dose would have been $32,000. That's the wholesale acquisition cost of that drug. The clinic billed this patient $97,000, $65,000 over the wholesale acquisition cost. There was no explanation as to why the clinic was billing above that rate. This committee has heard several bills this session about the cost of pharmaceuticals impacting patient access and the role of manufacturers. However, hospitals and clinics are also to blame when they marked up the cost of the drugs that are already some of the most expensive on the market. House Bill 544 takes away a tool to address healthcare affordability. In closing, again, this is all avoidable. If provider groups strongly believe in wanting to maintain current practices and avoid white bagging requirements, all they need to do is end their regular practice of marking up specialty drugs. Patients should not be expected to overpay for the care they need, and we support the DE1 amendment as a patient-centered compromise to providers and patients. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Bentley Graves. Mr. Graves.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Bentley Graves from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I often introduce myself as being from the Chamber, representing more than 6,000 employers across the state, in every corner of the state, in every industry of the state. And that includes health industry members who find themselves on both sides of this this issue. And so on behalf of our broader membership, our employer members who ask us to go to the Capitol and advocate on their behalf for quality, affordable health care for themselves and employees, I want to thank Representative Freiberg and this, the committee for digging into this issue and looking for a way forward on the bill. You know, we too, when this issue first came forward, we too started looking for a solution. That took us to looking at this issue and how it was handled in some other states, including a report that was done in Massachusetts several years ago, commissioned by the legislature, done by the Massachusetts Health Policy Commission, looking specifically at white bagging and making recommendations. And I want to share a couple of the findings and then just one of the recommendations with you. As far as findings go, the report did find that prescription drug prices are substantially lower with white bagging, and that the price of prescription drugs through third-party specialty pharmacies is generally significantly lower than the buy-and-bill method. We heard some discussion earlier about the out-of-pocket concerns that the increased out-of-pocket costs that may go along with white bagging. But this report noted that the patient cost sharing doesn't differ substantially between a buy-and-bill and a white bag method, and that the difference in out-of-pocket, while minimal, really depends on the cost of the drug and the benefit design for the enrolled beneficiary. As far as the solution goes, the report suggested looking at a site-neutral payment policy that addresses the many safety concerns that have been brought forward that I think are really kind of provide the thrust for this bill, but still maintain some of the cost control mechanisms to try and check the growth in the increase in prescription drugs and continue to allow folks in Minnesota to access somewhat affordable and quality health care. But again, I appreciate the role of the committee and Representative Freiberg are taking here to move us forward towards a compromise. We do think that something akin to a site-neutral payment policy gets at the safety concerns while still maintaining some of that cost control. But I really appreciate the opportunity to offer that input, Mr. Chair. Happy to answer questions.
All right, thank you. Next we have Michelle Mack. Ms. Mack.
Good afternoon, Chair Stevenson and members of the committee. My name is Michelle Mack, and I'm a senior director at the Pharmaceutical Care Management Association, or PCMA. PCMA represents America's Pharmacy Benefit Managers, or PBMs. PCMA appreciates the opportunity to provide testimony on House File 544 and greatly appreciates the informational amendment and look forward to working with Representative Freiberg and proponents of the bill further. PBMs and their health plan and employer clients use specialty pharmacies to deliver high-quality, accessible pharmacy services while promoting product affordability. Flexibility to continue contracting with these select pharmacies is the key to ensuring access and promoting affordability in Minnesota. When an employer or health plan decides to contract with a PBM to administer their pharmacy benefit, they maintain authority over the terms and benefit plan design, including how drugs should be obtained by or delivered to beneficiaries. The employer or plan, not the PBM, makes decisions regarding cost-sharing requirements, formularies, and networks, including the use of mail delivery of a drug to a patient or provider. In limiting a plan sponsor's choices to allow white bagging, this bill would substantially increase costs for Minnesota consumers and plan sponsors. Our research, which should be in your packets, shows that in the first year alone, restricting white bagging will cost Minnesotans $176 million in excess drug spending. While the vast majority of drugs are shipped that do not require special handling or packaging, for those that do, mail service pharmacies use U.S. Pharmacopoeia guidelines to determine handling needs and leverage proprietary software to map out the ideal packaging journey. The safety and efficacy of mailed prescriptions is of utmost importance and is well reflected in the level of precision and planning undertaken by specialty pharmacies. Specialty pharmacies and mail delivery are tools used in pharmacy networks because they ensure high quality drug delivery service, avoid waste, and ensure appropriate use of the medications. I thank you for your time and consideration, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. And finally, we have Nick Zerwas. Mr. Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, for the record, my name is Nick Zerwas.
I work for the Jacobson Law Group. We represent the American Health Insurance Plans. It should also be noted we represent CVS Caremark, although we're not testifying on their behalf today. The American Health Insurance Plans appreciates the opportunity to provide testimony today's hearing. Specialty drugs prices are high, and those prices continue to grow. Specialty drug share of net spending rose from 27% in 2010 to over 50% in 2020. These markups that we see in hospitals and physician clinics tend to be quite excessive. AHIP recently released a study where we analyzed the 10 most common intravenously delivered drugs that are used often in white bagging. And what we found is that the cost per single treatment for administration of that drug in a hospital was on average $7,000 higher in a hospital per dose and $1,400 higher on average per dose in a physician's office that doesn't allow white bagging. Hospitals on average charge double the price for the same drugs compared to specialty pharmacies. It's the same drug, shipped the same way, administered in the same medical setting, double the price. Prices were 22% higher in physicians' offices for the same drugs on average. The impact as we start to see biologics, biosimilars, and other rare specialty drugs, the impact and cost of care delivery is enormous on our premium payers and the impact on those that we contract for. The idea set forth in the DE1 amendment to really tackle the safety issues, those concerns, and make sure that we can deliver those drugs in a manner that caps the impact on pricing is something that we continue to pledge our support and continue to work with the author and the chair as this bill moves forward.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Having gone through testimony, we'll now turn to member discussion. Discussion to the bill or amendment. Representative Beer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could we have the a testifier from Children's come up, and maybe also from Mayo, Mr. Sefchi, I think his name was?
We could have, yeah, Ms. Snyder and Ms. Sefchi, or Mr. Sefchi, excuse me. While they're getting settled, why don't you go ahead and
Yes. So was it Ms. Snyder? Yes, thank you. Thank you for your testimony. I just wanted to dig in a little bit deeper. You talked about a lot of delays with patient care. Can you go into a little bit just about what that delay is caused by? Is it just about prior authorization and who's going to pay the bill? And is that pretty much the fundamental issue?
Yeah. So it's a lot of the back and forth and making sure, like if you think of the cost for these families, they want to ensure that it's covered before. And so sometimes if we're getting delays, we'll reach out to both the insurance side and the pharmacy benefit side. And us and the patient families keep getting volleyed back and forth. So the medical benefit will say, no, it's carved out on the PBM side. And then if you talk to the PBM side, they'll say, well, if you want it to be infused and on the medical benefit, you need to talk to the insurer. And so it sends our staff in these circles and the patient families when they're trying to reach out in circles also. And so we just aren't getting answers. And so sometimes we'll try and escalate through the chain in which we're able to with, you know, our payer contracting teams. Sometimes we'll get replies from the payers, and other times we won't get responses. And so we're left not knowing where the patient stands with coverage.
Thank you. Just one follow-up on that. Yep. So when you're in this process and you're in the midst of it, are you looking at what it would cost and getting financial data for that the client, so you can talk about if you get it the one way versus the other, and is one of the options for Children's to procure and administer that drug so they get a cost comparison? Is that ultimately where you can get to or not?
That information is not visible to us. So on the pharmacy benefit side of things, we would not know the claim is adjudicated. We would not know what that cost is out of pocket to the patient. And then on the medical benefit side, when kind of hearing that the things are being charged up, what is actually covered may be different than what is actually charged out. So an insurer may say, we are going to pay you $80 for this medication. Could be a flat fee. Or it could be that they're going to pay a percent of the charge. So they may pay 60% of what we charge. And so it's different for different payers and different medications. So sometimes we may know that information and sometimes we may not with a particular health plan for that particular employer and patient.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Snyder. So it's difficult for patients, obviously. It's difficult for providers to ever get to a comparative price structure.
Yeah, and I have not viewed the amendment, but just hearing that, I was like, that information's not transparent to us, and I would love it if it was, actually. So hearing that, I was like, I would have to look and view the language, but just thinking of what I was hearing, I don't think that information is visible to us, but if it was, we would like that. We would be open to having those conversations, but it's not shared with us on that provider level.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, for Mr. Sepci from Mayo, the question I had, does Mayo utilize the drugs that are sent in white bagging form right now or not?
Mr. Sepci.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, our policy is to try to not white bag as often as we can. So our first, whenever we get a request to white bag, our response is, our policy at Mayo Clinic is not to white bag due to the safety and quality issues of this process. When the payer says the only way you can get this drug is through a white bagging process, then I have written the policy that outlines how we go through the steps to decide, is this a patient we will treat at Mayo Clinic? Is this a patient that we help find another place that will be treated because it's in their best interest to go there? Or is this, or what do we do to work with the patient to go through this process?
Thank you. One last question, Mr. Chair, and that is, so as you go through that process, is one of the steps in the process to analyze the cost to the patient?
We're just like the Children's Hospital. We do not get any of the information from the prior authorization or the PBMs on what this is going to cost.
Thank you. No further questions. I just want to state an article I read in the newspaper recently for people searching for drug costs and trying to lower them. A business in Arizona sent their patient to the Cayman Islands to get their Humira because it saved them money, and they couldn't save that money in this country. It's rather pathetic.
Called medical tourism.
Thank you.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to all the testifiers and to Representative Freiberg. This is not an easy bill, obviously. The question I had was kind of a little bit addressed here by this last couple of testifiers, but I would really like to ask the insurance folks. So Mr. Andreessen and Mr. Zerwas, the question really is, both of you have referred to these costs that are billed that are so much higher. And my question to you is, isn't it true that providers bill all kinds of stuff and the insurance industry doesn't ever pay just, oh, you billed it, we'll just pay it? I mean, that doesn't, to me, seem to really mean much, and I think it was just addressed a little. So I'd kind of like to hear you. The example you've given several times now that we talked about in my office, was that amount that was billed to that patient, was that the amount the insurance actually paid for the drug?
Mr. Andreessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, so in that example, so it was billed at $97,000. The insurer said, you know, we'll pay the contracted rate, and then that was what went through the system. Now, fortunately, we in Minnesota, we have good balanced billing laws, because otherwise that provider can come back to the patient and say, you owe us the $65,000 that is the balance here. So that would happen with insurance. Now, if you didn't have insurance, you would pay that $97,000, and likely that patient would not choose to do that. So, you know, and this is, you know, we hear this all the time from drug manufacturers. They say, well, the wholesale acquisition cost, that's somewhat, nobody's buying drugs at that level, but some are.
and that's the start of negotiation. So if they're overcharging from what they've already bought the drug for, that's causing an issue with everybody's insurance.
Representative Lieberman.
Thank you for that. Well, you know, I think that the insurance companies have a lot more visibility into that than the providers do. I think Representative Bierman was kind of pointing that out as well. I mean, this is a pretty complicated thing, but I just think that from what I'm hearing here, maybe it's true that we need to put some kind of controls on what the providers charge. I mean, I'm not saying that wouldn't be a possibility, but I think it's a little bit unfair, the comparison of what's being charged and we don't really have any information really here about what's being paid for the drug under a white bagging scenario and under a provider scenario. So anyway, I just thought that was, and when you say that we don't balance bill in Minnesota, we don't balance bill. So in Minnesota, that we're not, the patient is not gonna end up paying the difference. So I guess if Mr. Zerwas wanted to, I don't, we don't have a lot of time, Mr. Chair, but if he wanted to sort of answer the same question, because he's kind of here on behalf of.
You may have to repeat it. I think Mr. Zerwas was in the hallway when you asked the question.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
I was.
No, it was just the point being that insurers don't really pay the billed price. So if you're comparing, the provider billed X amount in your testimony, you're talking about how much was billed for the drug as opposed to how much, you know, was paid under the white bagging scenario. And I'm saying that's kind of an apples and oranges scenario, is it not? Because insurance companies negotiate and they don't pay the provider just whatever the provider bills.
Isn't Mr. Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Liebling, for the question. I think there's an area in there that kind of you meet in the middle, or there's some changes. I think the challenge is when you talk about a contracted rate or a negotiated rate, the minute you stop allowing for white bagging, and so there is no alternative, and so the drugs need to be given at the physician's office, provided by the physician's office, and the drug needs to be provided procured by the hospital, and that rate, there's no leverage to negotiate a rate. There's no leverage to negotiate a payment. It's the only option. Now, if this were to pass, mandated by law. And so that's where a huge concern is, as far as the provider or the payers go, is the idea that once this is mandated, and there is no leverage for renegotiation, that impacts even more going forward. But the studies that I have seen and I can provide to the committee, where they were provided to your committee, we had an email problem yesterday, so I didn't get my letter into Mr. Brown, but I can certainly get to the committee, has access to that study that would show you the markups that I referenced in my testimony, and that's what my testimony is based off of today, Chair Laban.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and as we come to the conclusion of today's committee hearing, I'm reminded of a season finale cliffhanger. It seems to me like we have a lot of work that needs to be done on both sides of this issue, and I think it's also extremely important that both sides use the time that's available to try to come to an equitable solution on this, because as I have said many times in this committee, the legislature will make a decision, and we don't like to pick winners and losers if we don't have to. The best for all is when the parties are together. They like something, they don't like something, and we can get a negotiated settlement on here. And so I'm going to reserve any other comments until the time that we get the omnibus bill and see if we can get some things worked out in the next week and a half or so. And again, I'll reserve my comments at that point as we come to the next season, if you will, of white bagging.
I think we can all agree that we would like to stop talking about white bagging at the legislature. Chair Freiberg, closing comments.
Are you sure you want me to talk about white bagging some more? I'll just say testifiers in support said opponents would try to make this about hospital costs. As we've mentioned, this bill does not prohibit white bagging. It just does not allow it to be required. That's an important distinction.
If the cost of a white bag medication is lower from a provider-owned pharmacy, the patient can still go there, even if the bill as introduced is passed. But I understand there will be continuing discussions about this, so I look forward to seeing what comes of all of these discussions. And thank you for members' consideration and insightful questions and comments.
Thank you. With that, the bill is laid over. And with that, the meeting is adjourned.